Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Mid-Rack, where the Navy Mil Blog community's top bloggers discuss the latest developments, long-term trends, and the way forward for the Navy Marine Corps team and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody, to the 2nd of May 2010 edition of Mid-Rats. Now that you're through prancing around the Maypole and wearing your Che Guevara shirts up and down the street, settle down, enjoy the evening. We're going to focus on today is the 2010 election. Believe it or not, it's just 6 months away. 6 months is forever in politics, but when you reach a certain age, 6 months also lasts about 2 days. And we're going to kind of use as a foundation is a quote that came from at the end of Scott Brown's campaign last year, and those that have visited us on the website have seen it, where even though the big topic of discussion at that point was healthcare and all these other domestic issues, that a very strong undercurrent of his success in Massachusetts was national security. And it's something that you're just one headline away from, again, popping up to the top of the list of things that we're going to be concerned about. So that's what we're going to do today, whether you're joining us live or whether you're catching us on the archive or on the podcast. And our guest today will be Mackenzie Eglin. She is a research fellow of national security at the Heritage Foundations. And also on hold to come on after Mackenzie will be James S. Robbins. He's a senior editorial writer for Foreign Affairs at the Washington Times, author of the book Last in Their Class, Custer, Pickett, and the Goats of West Point. He's also a political commentator and contributing editor for National Review Online. And for those that are catching us live, just as a reminder, go ahead and hop on the chat room at the bottom of the show page. Eagle One's going to ride herd on there. If you have questions for our guests, comments, or if you'd like them something to clarify in the course of our discussion, feel free to put it there in the chat room, and Eagle One will fold it right in with the rest of the usual suspects. Now we're going to go ahead and move forward with our show, and our first guest tonight is going to be Mackenzie Eglin from the Heritage Foundation. Mackenzie, welcome again to Mid-Rats.
Thanks very much.
Well, you're welcome, and I just wanted to remind our listeners this is Mackenzie's second visit, another returning guest, so we didn't scare her away too bad, and we appreciate it. Let me ask you, have they finally finished up all the construction in front of the Heritage Foundation?
The Eagle has landed, proverbially and literally, at the Heritage. We have finished the facade and the landscaping out front, and we now have this beautiful Eagle out front that's a statue, and you need to check it out next time you're in town.
Outstanding, and I would encourage everybody to do that. If you're up in Capitol Hill, you're not even half a mortar shot away from the Heritage Foundation. It's a short walk up there. They got a real great facility there, well worth your time. And when we're talking about national security and the election coming up in 2010, I mean, we talked a little bit about what happened in Massachusetts, and I think that really set a tone, because when you pick up the newspapers, yeah, all you're reading about is the ongoing discussion of the health care, the cap and trade issue. Now we have the Arizona issue. But when you look at a lot of the internal polling and what a lot of the concerns are, it's national security. And I think if we go back to the election of Senator Brown, there were things that were going on in the background that would pop above the ambient noise and would get people's attention. And you really are just one headline away from having everybody talk about what may or may not be in a state law somewhere to, hey, look, somebody has a car bomb ticking away in Times Square, and what are we doing to prevent these things? And one thing I wanted to bring up on you, because I know you've done some good work on it over there at the Heritage Foundation with a lot of your colleagues, is in national security, everybody has been talking about Iran, but when you pull the string on Iran and the nuclear forces, I always like to go back to what used to be called back in 2003 when they picked up the EU3, which was Britain, France, and Germany. And they put out statements like measures aimed at the settlement of all outstanding IAEA issues with regard to the Iranian nuclear program and enhancing confidence in peaceful cooperation in the nuclear field. You can read quotes from the last month that almost read the same, where when you look at what Iran's doing, and it's you don't really have to be that brilliant to see, it's even covered in the hadiths and in the Quran what you want to do, that is talk, delay, build, talk, delay, arm, talk, delay. And do you see, Mackenzie, in the last few weeks there's been more discussions of sanctions. That's been going on for a few years. Do you see the Iranian issue, barring any North Korea-like underground explosion announcing to the world they succeeded, where the Iranian issue could really bubble above the background and become an issue in November?
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm not one who wants for headlines like, you know, thwarted terrorist attack, Christmas Day bomber, and Times Square car plot averted, and things like that. But nonetheless, I do think that Iran is the simmering pot just waiting to boil over, and that it's inevitable because their leaders have domestic concerns and audiences that worry about, just like any politician, and the regime, like others, of tyrannical regimes, is focused on survival, and they also are in tuned with U.S. political election cycles. You know, every time we tend to overstate or overdo something in our talks or engagements, they blow us off on purpose because it strengthens their PR back home. You're right about the sanctions. This is something that, my goodness, how many times are we going to go back to this well? Sanctions are, I believe, a solution for politicians and policymakers who want a quick fix for Iran, although if you study it like you have, you know that this is just what they use. And they say, well, the next round of sanctions will be the most important. They'll be tougher than the last round. But it's for people who aren't sure what to do about Iran, something between sanctions and deterrence and bombing the country or just letting them get a nuke outright. There are no clear answers, and there's definitely no easy, quick solution. And so sanctions continues to be the sought-after choice when it's clear it's not working.
And I forgot to mention early on that my co-host today, of course, is Eagle One from Eagle Speak. And, Mackenzie, just one follow-on question before I tee it up over to Eagle One is, and something's come up again on sanctions, which the first time I heard it a few years ago, I kind of had said, could you repeat that to me again? Because when people think of Iran, they think of, hey, big oil company. But actually, they have a rather significant Achilles heel, and that has to do with refined petroleum products and gasoline. They actually have to import that. And at first blush, that looks like a real sexy, shiny pebble. But if you really went at that in a sanctioned regime, there's a lot of second and third order effects from that. Is that one of those apparent Achilles heel that looks really shiny and attractive when you first look at it, but when you really peel back the onion, you realize that there might be enough blowback if you did something like that, that it's really not a soft option you could go for?
I think that's a fair point. I think the administration really needs to, for once and a little bit strangely this year, actually follow Congress's lead and not oppose sanctions against firms that export gasoline and refined petroleum to Iran. You know, the White House is dragging its feet on this, arguing that it could slow down its diplomatic efforts at the Security Council, even though nobody expects the UN to actually impose sanctions that are so-called crippling on this regime. I mean, the bottom line is sanctions have to specifically target the internal security workings of the regime. So that includes, for example, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the Quds Force, their intelligence services, their police, and their Basij militia. I mean, these are the true offenders, and those are the people that need to be targeted, as opposed to something that could affect the general mass population in Iran and further inflame and ignite and hurt our diplomatic efforts and confuse ordinary Iranians about what we're trying to do there.
Eagle One.
Well, Mackenzie, I'm going to give you the easy question first. From a heritage point of view, or from your personal point of view, what are the key national defense issues that are going to pop up as we head into the 2010 election?
Well, I think Iran is absolutely top of the list, and I wish this world was not such a mosaic, but it really is connected. You know, national security is really international security and domestic security all in one. As we've seen, you know, just last night, again with Times Square and Detroit Christmas Day bombing, and even things like, U.S. military response to Haiti and even possibly helping with the oil spill. All of these things are connected to larger issues that confront our security apparatus and, frankly, ask for more time and resources from our hard and soft power tools as well as just our national attention, which I do believe are linked to Iran. I don't think North Korea is out of the headlines either. The North Korean leadership now has an intermediate-range ballistic missile controlled by its senior leadership, and something people don't realize is that they just opened a new military and intelligence command structure in North Korea, which indicates an advancement in this in their nuclear program. So we're seeing North Korea and Iran really step up their development, and they love to saber rattle and flaunt it to the world, whether it's a testing or a launch or a satellite or something, or talking to regimes in Venezuela. Whatever it is, they do like to remind us every 6 months or so that they're around and their programs are advancing. And Americans intuitively, while they don't connect it outright, you know, these things to Al-Qaeda in Yemen and Christmas Day bombing, they do intuitively understand that this the world is a chessboard, and these are often connected, these larger problems, and we have to address all of it. We cannot exclusively focus on Iraq and Afghanistan, but they also understand that's really hard to do also. So I see Iran and North Korea continue to be in the headlines. I absolutely see Afghanistan as a continuing challenge for this administration and for policymakers in general, based on, you know, the doubling down, so to speak, on the ground there and hoping that things will turn around. It's a true counterinsurgency strategy right now, but the U.S. didn't commit, I'd argue, the White House didn't commit enough resources to this new plan, and take the mission in Haiti. That diverted a lot of troops that literally were in the flight line queue headed to Afghanistan, and some resources that were already there, like heavy strategic airlift. You know, we cannot be everywhere. Each plane and ship, as you guys know, can only be one place at one time. And not only do we know that, but our enemies know that, and our potential enemies know that. So I see all of these things linked. And the last issue to come up will certainly be just in general seeking to do us harm, detainees, and everything linked therein, not just the potential attacks and who claims credit for them, but also, what is the America's detainee policy? What are we doing with Guantanamo? Will Khalid Sheikh Mohammed have a domestic trial? And things really are important to the American people.
For those last few issues, Mackenzie, when you're talking about the detainees and the trials coming up, between now and the November election, are there any hard dates when decisions are going to have to be made? Or because these are known landmines and issues that quickly grab people's attention, and you can draw some pretty sharp lines between this is, yes, he should be tried here, no, he should not, yes, we keep Gitmo open, no, we close it. Is there a hard date between now and November that those decisions will be made, or is that something that they can push to the right and hope that it doesn't come up on anybody's radar screen before November?
It certainly has moved to the back burner. My understanding was, you know, several months ago, the Justice Department was plowing ahead with its plans to hold basically a civilian trial for KSM in New York. And not only that, but the federal government had visited the prison in Illinois that it wants to call Gitmo North and purchase and acquire and then reopen with new security standards or whatever, and move a lot of the detainees that may or may not ever be released to Illinois. And we haven't heard a peep about any of these things in a while. And I think that's because, I mean, the president said after Detroit that he was still going to move ahead with closing Guantanamo. And it was the pressure from Congress saying Al-Qaeda in Yemen is which was its leader there, was linked to the Fort Hood massacre perpetrator, which was linked to a guy released from Guantanamo. This really is all connected. And only when Congress, you know, linked the dots, said, whoa, what are you doing? The White House, under public pressure, said, you know, we're going to halt transfers to Yemen of detainees from Gitmo. So, you know, that was one small walking step backward. But as far as the KSM and the Gitmo, things seem to be plowing ahead, albeit either quietly or they're just halting it temporarily, but I don't see it going away. And the closer we get to the elections, nobody's stupid in Washington. They'll probably just let it simmer until, of course, January.
It almost seemed to me like over the Valentine's Day weekend, a bunch of people had a meeting and said, we just need to push this and shut up about it and just get on to other things because it's killing us. Eagle One.
Well, one of our users on the chat room asked the question, given the recent events showing the vulnerability of offshore oil infrastructure, should be more worried about the Gulf of Guinea than worry about the Persian/Arabian Gulf?
I think it's fair to say that the U.S. has exposed itself with a lot of our national security tools, so to speak, that we're having trouble walking and chewing gum at the same time on a lot of foreign policy issues, actually responding to them in a coherent, strategic manner, but also in our ability to conduct operations or enforce sanctions or do all of the other soft power things. We frankly have a military and a Coast Guard too small to do what we want, what the nation asks it to do every day. Add on that the things that the Pentagon needs planning for, other contingencies and scenarios outside of what we're currently doing, like, for example, an Iranian engagement or an amphibious assault of North Korea. These things are not being done, as far as I can tell, in the public domain, of course. And that's a problem, because if you and I know that, I think the whole world can see that. You know, we've heard a lot of enemies, challengers, and aggressors around the world basically see what was exposed in Iraq, which was that it tied down so many national resources at once when we had been for the last 20 years saying that we can fight, for example, two major conventional wars at once, but we never really had that capability. We knew it, but nobody else did, and that worked. Now everyone can know our vulnerabilities even more than they did before. And like I said, this is not just a pure military front, but it's also contingencies and scenarios we need to be planning for and hedging against, like other regions of the world, the Pacific, Gulf of Guinea, et cetera, the Arctic, that we need to care about and be concerned about, because other people, other things are going on and we're not responding to them. You know, the Russian invasion of Georgia, was our U.S. foreign policy limited by default because we didn't have the assets to actually respond the way we wanted to? You know, these are the kinds of questions and vulnerabilities that may be resting in the minds of other people around the world that should matter to us.
Well, is there going to be a serious discussion? I mean, it's always hard to say that ahead of time by anybody running for the Senate or for the congressional seats about how much money is going to go, save to the new Obamacare, that really needs to be spent on national defense and securing our borders and all that good stuff. Do you see that as a major part of this upcoming campaign?
I do, and I don't think I live in a D.C. bubble. It's too much to think that. I have family elsewhere, and I do check in on their pulse every now and then. And, you know, the Arizona immigration law and the border security issue, you know, these two are always linked for a policymaker, secure borders and immigration. And all of these potential attacks against the United States, not just Christmas Day in New York City last night, but Fort Hood again, you know, these are also all linked in people's minds. And even if there may or may not be, like, say, for example, a KSM trial in New York, these issues are always at the top of voters' agendas. They have been since 9/11. It's different now. It's not so much Iraq and concern about the war. Americans just are generally, I sense, based on what I hear and read and polling, et cetera, that security remains an issue. And if, for whatever reason, it could be that people just aren't feeling overly secure today And a lot of that has to do, I would argue, with economic security. I don't believe that's a conservative position to say that. I think people generally know that economic growth is linked to your ability to defend your country and provide, you know, all of the resources necessary to do that, whether that's homeland security or military or national security or state foreign aid, whatever it is you want to do. Those things are limited default when you're exploding your domestic spending. We have a finite budget pie. And so I think there's insecurity across the board, economic, and it bleeds into national security. And so I do see these issues as coming up. Immigration is just one venue and avenue into leading into a discussion of homeland security. And I see this as something that, even though I agree completely with Commander Salamander, this is 6 months is a long time. Like I said, I see this coming up over and over.
I think especially once the primary season is over with, that these things will come into focus more and more and more. And when you look at international relations and how the world works amongst nation states in a very crude way, some of the less refined ways that we send signals to each other, especially nations that aren't the best of friends, is you send signals of strength and signals of weakness. And one thing that just hasn't shocked me or surprised me, so to speak, but really has taken me back in the last year especially, is when you look at the relationship of the United States and Israel, or the great Satan and the little Satan, depending upon who you're talking to. And the firmness of that relationship has always had a deterrent effect in many ways against those who would wish both Israel and, frankly, ourselves harm. And when you're dealing with Iran, especially that uncertainty that is there, that is derived from the closeness of our relationship, it has worked well for us in the past. But the way that I've seen Israel treated in the last year in a very public way, and in a way that I don't think a lot of people appreciate when you look at Middle Eastern culture, is very much a shame-based culture. And we have done things very publicly that has put shame on Israel and the Israeli leadership. And for whatever reason that is being done, is that translating into domestic politics? Those who have been very strong supporters of Israel, but also very strong supporters of the Democrat Party, has that caused some people to come out and perhaps, if not readdress their political feelings and allegiances, but to at least think twice about it?
There's certainly some movement in D.C. when the senior senator from New York, Chuck Schumer, told the White House publicly through, you know, various public fora, they've got to rein it in on their Israel bashing. You know, the White House has had a lot of doublespeak on this, and the Secretary of State call it threw fuel on a fire that has been burning for weeks. And, you know, then all of a sudden, about a week ago, the White House, you know, doubled over its efforts to say that this is a special relationship, that they're our longstanding ally, that we are here to defend Israel, you know, forever and infinitely under any circumstance. And this is sharp rhetoric change from literally just 1 month ago. And I believe that's just that's because they were given a sit down, a man to man, so to speak, a come to Jesus with a lot of people in Washington. And this wasn't conservatives publicly berating the president that, you know, made him yield like the Gitmo transfers. This really came from within. This is something that's a bipartisan issue. It's not exclusive to one side or the other, you know, defending Israel and its security inherently, particularly with a growing threat from Iran. And the White House seems to have caught on to that, albeit a little late, but you've picked up on something really interesting, which is this theme of shining sunshine on longstanding U.S. policy, a lot of it implemented post-World War II and with various foreign policy with various countries, where we've had strategic ambiguity for a reason. Israel is one of them, but we've also done this in the arms control and non-proliferation realm as well. And we're seeing this White House very comfortable with just instantly snapping its fingers and changing policy overnight that's been instituted for decades under presidents of both parties for a reason, because of the U.S. leadership role in the world that we've held since 1945, whether we like it or not. And, you know, this theme of thinking that we are just, you know, this is the new right answer, and the backlash, the immediate backlash that we've seen, for example, with Israel is obvious. But what I'm concerned about is the long-term consequences of this, that we have no idea what we're giving up when we tell the world, hey, here's our new START treaty with Russia, for example, and we're going to give away the farm, and they don't have to do anything. And, oh, by the way, they're all modernizing their nuclear forces, Russia and China and everybody else, and Iran transferring missiles to Hezbollah and Hamas, et cetera. This ambiguity is part of our foreign policy, and I'm not sure we want to give that away, but we seem to be doing that a lot lately.
Eagle One.
Well, to continue the theme of giving things away and ambiguity, North Korea, we seem to be receiving a lot of tests from them. I'm not convinced that the recent sinking of that South Korean patrol ship wasn't done by one of their torpedoes, which, you know, sends a message back to the U.S. Their shipments of missiles and information to Iran. It's the bipole of evil, I guess, if we knocked out one of the legs of the axis, I don't know what we're left with. But what are we going to do about North Korea? What how do we make people take that one seriously?
Well, for starters, we have to make it look like we haven't taken our eye off the ball with North Korea, and I fear that we have. You know, anytime the U.S. tends to talk about missile defense these days, you know, it's in the context of Iranian short and medium range missile threats. Well, if I'm Iran and North Korea, and the U.S. has explicitly advertised that it's not going to focus on long-range ballistic missile threats armed with nuclear weapons or any type of WMD, then that's exactly where I'm going to move my investment towards. Not to mention, anything you learn in a short and medium-range program and testing and development can be applied to a long-range program. We've advertised to the world that we're not going to focus on that. It's going to be 10 years from now. And so first and foremost, we need to tell everybody we can do it all. Even if we can't, we need to try. We're going to do our best to defend against all types of threats from nuclear weapons, particularly long-range programs. And to let the world know that just because you know, we're trying to engage with Iran and simultaneously push sanctions, that we have not stopped thinking about the threat from North Korea, particularly, as you noted, with the recent development there. This new intermediate-range ballistic missile development controlled in Pyongyang is very concerning. These were first deployed in 2007 as asserted by the South Korean Ministry of Defense, but the capability has been advanced. In fact, I'd argue it's reached full operational capability. And this is really interesting, and this is, again, back to this sort of chessboard and how everything in national and international security is connected. These can reach U.S. air and naval forces in Japan, Okinawa, and Guam. And this indicates that deployment of this type of missile would enable North Korea to attack our staging bases in any scenario where we would respond to North Korean provocation or hostilities. You know, and this is also linked to missile defense and our nuclear posture. When North Korea launched its test earlier this year, the Secretary of State was on Meet the Press, and her very first question was, well, what are we doing about it? Her immediate answer was, well, we have missile defense, but we're scaling back in that realm, and the President is considering, you know, dramatic changes in our nuclear posture right now as part of, you know, things pending before Congress. And all of these things, our actions speak louder than our words. And that's what's really concerning with the North Korea threat, because we're basically being shown we could be held hostage in a certain type of response scenario there. And we're dressing down all of our other capabilities while they're all building up.
Yeah, Mackenzie, I thought that statement of saying, you know, we have missile defense is kind of like the Republicans saying we have the House of Representatives up. It's nice to talk about, and the theory might actually be there, but operationally it's not where we need to quite be right now. And as we come up to the bottom of the hour, Mackenzie, I wanted to thank a lot for you coming on again this evening. But if our listeners are interested in hearing more about the Heritage Foundation and the things that they do for national security or some of the work that you've been doing so far this year, where would be a good place for them to go?
It'd be great if they could visit heritage.org and just click on Protect America. We have a lot of stuff on missile defense, on Iran, and on the U.S. military, and, of course, the Navy and the Coast Guard. And I really appreciate being here because, as you can tell, I could talk to you and your listeners all night long about it.
I know, but you kind of broke my heart because I spent some time on show prep. I was going through some of the items you had over at heritage.org. You all have some really good stuff about which direction the Navy's going in, submarine levels. We have got to find an excuse to get you back here, Mackenzie. It's been great having you. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. These issues are so important. Thank you.
Thank you, Mackenzie.
Thanks.
And just a reminder to everybody here, you are listening to Navy Mil Blog Radio, Midrats. I'm Sal, your host, and along with the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak as our co-host. Our next guest is James S. Robbins. He's a senior editorial writer for Foreign Affairs at the Washington Times. He's also the author of a book many of you will be familiar with, A Last in Their Class, Custer, Pickett, and the Goats of West Point. He's also a political commentator and contributing editor for National Review Online. Jim, welcome to Midrats.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hey, I didn't think you'd mind too much following up somebody from Heritage. It's a good 1-2 punch, I think.
You know what? Mackenzie has already expertly and perfectly covered everything, so I really don't have a lot to add to that.
Well, we can go into a baseball show. Awesome.
Yeah, we could talk about the Kentucky Derby. That'd be all right.
Hey, I feel pretty lucky that, in fact, you know, I'm firmly ensconced and protected behind my berms of beach sand, palm trees, and Hawaiian shirts way down south here. But you're up in D.C., and I know one of the big stories here is what's happened a little further north, and that is the apparent attempt of some kind of car bomb in Times Square that luckily they didn't have a properly trained engineer working on or any freshman from the Naval Academy. It sounds like could have built a better one. If you could, being in D.C. and being in the Beltway and knowing that you're in the X ring of targets along with New York City, what are the thoughts there about this developing story, and what does this remind everybody inside the information ecosystem that they need to be concerned about?
You know, I think most people who live and work in Washington, particularly people who are involved in national security, folks who've worked in the government or the military, this is part of their everyday thing. I worked in the government for 10 years, including, you know, around 9/11 and after. I actually witnessed the aircraft hit the Pentagon where friends of mine were working. Luckily, none of them were killed. And, I mean, people all have stories of that day, and just people in Washington are hyper aware of these things. You're reminded every day if you're driving in on I-395, there are signs, you know, if you see something, report it, that kind of thing. So I think here it's not as surprising as it might be in other parts of the country to understand that these threats are out there, the enemy's trying to hit us, they'll do what they can to do it. Apparently, as you pointed out, they are utterly incompetent because, you know, who with a setup like that can't detonate their own car bomb? You know, they can't blow up an airplane, they can't blow up a car bomb. Hell, I don't know how they do it overseas, but apparently the guys they deploy to the U.S. just are not the A-team, you know? I think car bombs go off all the time elsewhere. They can't get it going in New York? Heck, well, that's good. I'm delighted that they're sending the minor leaguers to hit the great Satan. That just delights me no end. So, you know, hearing about it, I mean, really, it's part of everyday life in Washington. Other parts of the country, maybe not so much, but here, and particularly if you work in the national security environment or anywhere in the government where you're going through checkpoints all the time, it just becomes second nature. Showing your ID, having to deal with security, all those kinds of things, it's just what we do. I mean, it's the new normal.
If people were looking at a way to validate something that is often spoken about with derision, people talk about the flypaper strategy. Hey, let's kill them in Iraq and let's kill them in Afghanistan before they come here. Hey, maybe we have some evidence here that we're killing all the smart ones, and it's the bottom feeders that are found here. You know, knock on wood, anything could happen tomorrow. Eagle One, you got a question?
Yeah, I was wondering if that was a plug for his book, Last in Their Class. Perhaps these the guy that rigged the bomb in Times Square was last in his bomb-making class.
Not at all, because let me just say, the guys at West Point who graduated last in their class turned out some of the greatest heroes of that organization. So the whole point of that book was that the guys who came at the bottom had a different skill set than the guys at the top, but it was still a good skill set. The guys who are trying to light off bombs who can't do it, I don't think went to class. They were probably off at some strip bar or something.
Well, I was going to connect the your book to the recent opinion piece on we have too many A students running things in Washington. I was wondering if you saw a connection between your work and that particular line of thought.
Too many what students?
A students.
Oh, running things in Washington?
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting point that the people who are too smart for class kind of folks. Yeah, it's funny when, in fact, we address that in the book, that the people at the top of the class tend to have a certain type of knowledge, but it's not necessarily a useful type of knowledge. I mean, book smarts as opposed to street smarts. And, when you have too many people who are valedictorians running things, but you don't have anybody who ever paid a payroll, had to roll up their sleeves and actually work for a living. When you have all these honor student types running things, and by the way, I'm one of them, so I can be critical of it. You run into problems, and I think that the current administration is a little bit overloaded with the kind of people who have grown up being told that they're just the smartest thing, that they're just wonderful, that, you know, you should be president someday, you know, those kind of people. It's okay to have a few of those, but when you're overloaded with them, like we are in the current administration, you get the results of the current administration, which are heavy on abstractions, but kind of low on reality.
There was a great graph that came out about this time last year, I think, that it went back all the way to, I think, the Hoover administration, and it took cabinet officials and other major appointees that had experience in the private sector, Republican, Democrat, whatever, and kind of graphed it. And you talk about an outlier. This present administration not only maybe has, you know, one too many of the professorial type, but very few of them actually have practical experience and what it's like to, like you said, meet a payroll. There was also, I think you'll appreciate this, I don't know whether you had a chance to read a recent article that came out in Slate that was a profile of General Mattis. And one of the things that they mentioned about General Mattis, he's one of the few four-stars you'll find out there who is very openly against a military that wants everybody to be nice and sweet. One of his pet peeves is the move to not let sailors and Marines have their crotch rockets and cruise around and get speeding. And, you know, if somebody gets in one bar fight, they kicked out. It's like, you know what, this is a tough business. We need to have people that are willing to do tough things. And Eagle One, I think you had a follow-up to your previous question, or at least a 90-degree turn.
Well, yeah, it was a question actually posed by somebody on the chat room, which asked whether or not the Times Square bombing can be connected with the Pakistani Taliban, or is that just smoke? And that leads to the next question: is, as we ponder the upcoming election, how important is something like a Times Square attempted bombing going to play out in the next 6 months?
With respect to the Pakistani Taliban, I think that's just smoke. The group that claimed credit for it is a group that's claimed credit for other things in the past, and I think it's easy for them to do. On the other hand, no one else has claimed credit for it yet, and there's no reason to suspect that people in Pakistan couldn't project power into this country. There are a lot of extremists in this country with links to Pakistan, and Americans who are extremists who have links to Pakistan. So it's not out of the question, but I think the particular group that claim credit for it is probably just seeing opportunity and claiming credit for something they didn't do. With respect to it being an election issue, it's a little far out for it to directly affect the election, but it's another brick in the wall. We keep having incidents in this country. Luckily, not all of them are on the scale of, say, the Fort Hood massacre, but things keep happening. So how many things have to keep happening until something really bad happens? That's what I'm worried about. The administration has not shown a great track record in responding to these things. I mean, I'm waiting for them to pick up a suspect who's shouting Allah Akbar as they shove him into the police cruiser, and then some administration spokesman saying, well, this has nothing to do with Islam or nothing to do with Muslim extremism, something like that, like they did with Fort Hood, where they wouldn't even admit in the official force protection report that the shooter, Major Nidal Hassan, had anything to do with radical Islam. That is just bizarre to me. It is just strange. I know that we don't want to implicate the Muslim faith, and of course no one would, and President Bush was very upfront about that from the get-go at 9/11, saying we're not at war with Islam, we're at war with specific extremists. But the current administration, all they do is they just try to ignore the problem and hope it'll go away. And that's, in my opinion, the long-term election issue. If something is just so clearly connected to a particular brand of ideology that is at war with this country's basic freedoms, and you have an administration that absolutely will not face that fact, I think people are going to say, hey, these people in Washington just aren't trying their best to keep us safe.
And I think that's where you see the real soft underbelly when it comes to national security. If you want to draw a line between domestic and foreign, I think one of the smartest things that President Obama and his administration has done is managed to keep SecDef Gates in office. He almost seems like he is the blocking diode and the sanity check when it comes to national security involving the military, kind of the adult in the room. And as a result, they haven't had a Les Aspin-like character come in there who wanted to hold a lecture series in the Secretary of Defense's office instead of actually doing the job that it needs to be done. But when you look, like you mentioned, domestically, you're looking at the Attorney General Holder. When you look at what came out after the Fort Hood warning, the emails that were exchanged to me with people who are still on active duty and a few retired, it's just the whole report made people ill in its inability to actually address those hard issues. And what I was thinking about this weekend and what we started off this segment with is they've managed since about Valentine's Day to push down the Eric Holder issue and the Guantanamo Bay issue below the ambient noise. But we are literally away from one high school graduate designing a car bomb at the beginning of a marathon somewhere downtown New York City, L.A., Washington, D.C., to break above the background. If that happens before November, all those questions are going to be asked, and I really haven't seen anything by this administration that would bring warmth and comfort to any U.S. taxpayer that they are really have the right team trying to keep the bad guys out of their neighborhoods.
I would agree with that. And incidentally, since you mentioned Marathon, there was a report that just came out that at the Pittsburgh Marathon today, this afternoon, there was a pipe bomb discovered near the finish line. So go figure. Who knows what that was? But case in point, if that turns out to be another act of terrorism by, a politically motivated terrorist as opposed to just some, screwball, then 2 in 2 days, again, another brick in the wall. How many of these will it take before, A, something really bad happens, and, B, people understand that there's a fundamental problem in the system when you get these near misses again and again, which we didn't have before, because everybody in the system knew that no matter what happened, the administration would back them up. You know, whatever corners they had to cut, whatever they had to do to keep us safe, they knew that in the Bush administration, they weren't going to be hauled before Congress. They weren't going to be at some kind of hearing. They weren't going to lose their jobs. They weren't going to be splashed on the front page of the Washington Post. They weren't going to be contacted by the Justice Department, hauled off to jail for doing what they were told was a legal act to keep us safe. Okay, when you have an administration in which all those things go the other way, you have people throughout the system, throughout the government, saying when it comes to taking that extra measure, that extra risk, whatever it is to keep us safe, rather than doing it, they don't do it. And those are the things that add up. And I know those of you who've been in government and in the military and in the intelligence community, you know what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about acting illegally. I'm talking about those gray area things where it comes down to a judgment call of, do I want to do this or not? And when you think, well, if I'm risking my career, if I'm risking getting hauled before some special committee or special prosecutor or splashed on the front page of the Washington Post, am I going to do this? The answer is no.
Eagle One.
Well, at the same time, though, is it safer for people to focus on the, quote, domestic terrorism alleged with groups like the Tea Party people? Is that why the focus on that is so great? That's safe under this administration, but doing anything against actual enemies who may be coming in from other areas is not safe?
Well, you better believe it. When they did this takedown in Michigan of this, you know, hunting club or whatever it was, these screwball guys running around the woods in camo who were some kind of right-wing Christian, whatever it was. I'm not too clear on that. Whatever they thought they were doing, millenarial guys out in the woods. I am certain that was done because the people who did it figured, hey, this is a good way to advance our careers in this administration. You know, take down a group like this. This is what's going to get you ahead. This is what will come to the attention of superiors in the White House who will say, hey, good job, guys. You saved us from the threat of these guys, you know, eating venison jerky up in the woods in Michigan. Meanwhile, we have the number of incidents that keep piling up of actual threats where people are actually doing something, actually attempting to blow up bombs or actually shooting people. As in the case of Fort Hood or in Arkansas, the recruiting station shooting, whatever it happens to be, and how many of those is it going to take? I'm sorry to keep going back to that, but it's just the refrain. How many of those will it take until this administration admits there's a problem? And the problem is not just the threat to us, but it's also a problem in the administration itself.
You know, elections mean things, and elections have consequences. And not just who gets elected, but who those elected people appoint and promote. And just from the uniform side of the house, I'll step on a couple of toes here, but go back to something we mentioned before. After Fort Hood, Chief of Staff of the Army, his number one concern is, I hope our diversity doesn't suffer. You have, in a time of war, the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Ruffhead, continues to advertise that his number one priority is diversity. Again, a non-war fighting and socio-political issue. And tomorrow, we have the third court-martial, a Navy petty officer, for, in essence, giving somebody a fat lip who was responsible for the killing the people in Fallujah, the Americans in Fallujah, and then running their charred bodies up on a bridge for viewing. His two shipmates, of course, were acquitted last week in trial, and there was a general officer who decided that he was going to punish him for this alleged incident, and luckily those three petty officers basically told him to do what he wanted to with his paperwork, and they were going to take a court-martial and going through that. When we come to the 2010 election, you can't do anything about the executive branch, but if there's a change in the House or the Senate, you will get a change in those committee leaders. Do you see in the people who may come up on the Republican side of the House and the House and Senate some congressional and senatorial leadership that might help force people to focus on more critical issues than what we've heard in the last year.
Oh, yeah. Well, it'll have to be. And, I mean, I don't want to make any predictions, but the polling just makes it look like they're in a world of hurt. I mean, the Democrats are. We mentioned Israel before, and I saw a poll recently about Jewish support for Obama, and he came in with about 75% support from the Jewish community. It's now down to 42%. So Barack Obama has successfully done what Republican strategists have been trying to do for years, which is alienate the Jewish voter. And you can look across the board at all kinds of different key electoral groups, so people with high turnout rates, senior citizens are the highest turnout rate of any group. They're like the solid block against Obama. Moderate voters, just all kinds of folks are turning against the Democrats. You've got a Congress with the record low approval ratings. And when you look back, for example, at 1994, when the Republicans came into power after 40 years in the wilderness, the polling at this point in that election year was nowhere near this bad for the Democrats. So in a way, that may be a silver lining for the Democrats, because in 94, I don't think they knew they had a problem. Whereas now they know they have a problem and maybe they can do something about it. I doubt that. But once Republicans get in power, yes, new committee chairs, the control of the agenda, as Newt Gingrich said, was really the power of the speaker, was the power to recognize. And so the things that the Republicans will raise as issues are going to be different from what the Democrats do. But the other important power that's going to come, whether they take one or two houses, is the subpoena power, because this administration has done a lot of stuff that people just don't know about, or it's been kept secret, or it's been executive privilege, or what have you. And, of course, Democrats haven't really pushed those points. But once you have committee chairs starting to issue subpoenas for people to come and testify about stuff that they want to get answers to, and you have the administration getting their back up and trying to keep everything secret, it's going to number one, expose the hypocrisy of Obama claiming to have the most transparent administration in American history or whatever, you know, ridiculous claim they've made. But number two, I think the American people are going to learn a lot more about what's been going on in Washington over the last 2 years and how this administration has significantly weakened us in international affairs and international security, not to mention our economic future. So to me, the subpoena power is really the key thing that is going to change the game, especially looking down towards 2012, as some of the things that the Obama team has been trying to keep secret are going to start coming out.
Eagle One.
Yeah, which kind of leads to the question. A lot of the national defense issues are long lead time budgetary items that, you know, can the American public appreciate the fact that if they elect the right people in 2010, that downrange they're going to get better national security than if they keep on the present path? If not, how does the military make an argument that we're right at the, you know, we're at the breaking point now, and we're going to have to cut back seriously on important national issues without running through the famous barrier between what the military officers ought to be doing and in politics. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that you're right. Most of it is going to be more long-term, particularly when you talk about weapon systems acquisition, that kind of thing. Strategy, of course, will not be in Congress's purview, although I think that the reporting requirements will probably increase. The Congress will want to know more about what the Obama administration's up to. In terms of national security policy. And this, of course, will be a great case of karma and payback, since as a senator, Senator Obama was vitally interested in trying to impose more reporting requirements on the Bush administration. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of arguments they make against doing the same thing that Senator Obama thought was a great idea. With respect to sort of issues that Congress can directly affect, like Don't Ask, Don't Tell, I think that effort will be dead in the water, because that's going to require congressional action to change, and I have a strong suspicion that a Republican Congress would not be favorable towards changing that law. And then the rest comes down, I mean, in terms of affecting things in the near term, it comes down to where Congress wants to put money. Will they continue to fund efforts in Iraq, Afghanistan, and so forth? And I really don't see any change in that support. I mean, those support levels are going to remain high no matter who gets elected, if it's Republicans because they believe in the national security mission, and if it's Democrats, probably just because most of them, the sensible ones anyway, don't want to have the Taliban marching into Kabul on Barack Obama's watch.
Hey, Jim, I wanted to completely change your record here for a second, but I don't think you'll mind because it's about something you wrote. Last week on our show, we had as a guest retired Lieutenant Colonel Marine Corps J.G. Zumwalt. He has a new book out called Bare Feet and Iron Will, where he goes back and he spent a lot of time with North Vietnamese veterans of the Vietnam War. And he served there. His father was Admiral Zumwalt, and his brother served there in Riverine Squadron. And I read on Friday your review of Philip Jennings' book, An American Victory in Vietnam. And I just wanted to give you a second to talk about it, because one thing that we talked about last week with Jim Zumwalt is trying to educate people about the big lie and the big smear about Vietnam, you know, trying to explain to people about the 75 election and how that was actually a loss due to politics and cutting off money. Real fast, what is Philip Jennings really trying to get across in his book, America's Victory in Vietnam? And is there something we can pull out about the conversation and the war that we have right now?
Yeah, it's the politically incorrect guide to Vietnam, to the Vietnam War by Regnery Publishing, Philip Jennings. Really great book. Corrects a lot of the misperceptions about Nam that are out there. Just all of them, because there is so much noise out there about Vietnam that is just not true. And with respect to the victory in Vietnam, the argument there is that, well, as many veterans have said, I'm sure you've heard this before, we were winning when I left. You know, I'm sure you've heard that line before. And the fact is that, yeah, when you look at the Johnson period of the war from 65 to 69, the problem there was that we limited what we would do. We wouldn't go north. We wouldn't take the war to the enemy. We decided to fight the whole war in South Vietnam. We basically allowed the North Vietnamese to have safe havens in neutral Cambodia and Laos, which was illegal, but we let it happen. You know, these kinds of things. So that limited how we could win. During the Nixon period, the Vietnamization, we did a great job in terms of training up the South Vietnamese, giving them the air support, logistical support, intelligence support, and other things they needed to win set-piece battles against the North Vietnamese Army. We had the CAP program and other things going on in the countryside, helping to defeat the Viet Cong. And really, that was a great model for victory right there. I mean, we had the war under control in the early Nixon period. The problem was, when you had a Democratic Congress that was opposed to the war, cutting back on aid to Vietnam, cutting back on air support, cutting back on logistical support, eventually there was nothing the South Vietnamese could do. I mean, they wanted to fight, and they did fight, and they fought well. And it's wrong to say that the South Vietnamese Army was not a professional force, or that they, you know, they ran in the face of the enemy and so forth. This is not true. The problem in 1975 was, by then, Liberal Democratic Congress had cut all aid to South Vietnam, and when the North finally invaded in 75, the South Vietnamese ran out of ammo. I mean, it's as simple as that. They didn't have the air support they needed. When they ran out of ammunition and materiel, and we didn't back them up, what could they do? I mean, the North Vietnamese were backed by the Soviet Union and China. They could get anything they wanted,
and that
became a mismatch.
Yep, and that story is one that it's the truth, it what happened, but it was just put under the rug for so many years. It's starting to come out, and that's good, because I've always felt really bad for the Vietnam generation, as their story was never told. I think it's starting to, though. Hey, we've got about 30 seconds left, and I know a lot of my readers are a really big fan of your book, the last in their class. And I know you're a busy guy, but do you have another book in the works, or are you going to hold off for a while?
Oh, yeah. This in September, I have a book coming out on the Tet Offensive, speaking of Vietnam. It's called This Time We Win, because I think most of the knowledge about the Tet Offensive seems to suggest that we lost. So, hence the title, and should be out in September. This Time We Win.
That's beautiful, and I'll tell you what, if you get a spare half an hour when the book comes out, I'd love to have you on to talk about it, because we really like to tell that story whenever we get a chance.
Oh, you bet. Anytime.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Jim, and thank you for everybody that is listening live. And Eagle One, sorry we ran out of time for your last question. I ask again, please join us again next week for Mid-Rats, and I hope everybody has a great Navy Day.